My name's Terry and I'm an addict.
Hey, Terry.
It's great to be here with y'all. I have a very full heart tonight. My sobriety date is May the 23rd, 1991. I made it into this program because someone worked their 12 step on me. My journey began. I had no idea I was a drug addict. I had no idea I was an alcoholic, in spite of a long history of really like tragic experiences and stories that would go, oh my God, how could someone do that and still not know that there was something wrong with them? But my whole life, people had been telling me there was something wrong with me. I'm one of 10 children and second to the youngest. And, I started making a lot of mistakes. I was born in 1955. I love seeing some folks with my color hair here tonight. That always makes me feel right at home. When I came into Cocaine Anonymous, it was blonde. My whole life has changed, right? It's not like Cocaine Anonymous gave me back my life. My whole life was one crisis, it seemed, after another. And it wasn't that that's how I intended it to be, because my intentions have always been really good. You know, I'm a really good kid. I remember as a boy, I was so filled with dreams and ideals. I wanted to change the world. And, I had a lot of older brothers and sisters. And in the mid-1960s, things started going crazy in my household. And everybody was, all my older siblings were, the majority of them were dropping acid. And my sister was a Krishna. I don't know if any of you know what they were. You know, Hare Krishna. So my very first job at 11 years old was to sell the book of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. My sister was a Krishna, but she got her two little brothers to go sell the books for her. So she would give us the books, these great big books, and I'd go up and knock on the door, and the people would open the door, and I'm living in like suburbia of Los Angeles in a town called Monrovia, California, and I'd knock on the door, and the people would answer the door, and I'd say, hi. Well, I had like this. I'm here to sell the book of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Hare Krishna, Hare Rama. And then I'd sell the books, right? And people liked me. They bought from me. My whole life, people have bought what I sold. And just recently, when my sister and I, now that we're older, I said, I sold all those books. And she goes, I never gave that money to the Krishnas. But that would be her amends if she ever gets sober, not mine. But so that was my life, right? So my first drug, I didn't like weed because people were smoking there too. They're like lazy, and that wasn't me. And there were things that were happening in my childhood. There was for $1. I mean, you talk about a value. McDonald's, they all got their dollar value meals, right? Menus. Well, the dollar menu at Immaculate Conception Catholic School, where I was a seventh grader, the dollar menu was a roll of whites, 10 Benzedrines, or a rack of reds, 4 Seconals for $1. And I thought that was a great value, and I didn't really want to do the drugs, but I couldn't pass on the sale. So I got busted. In the seventh grade. Now, when I think of this, it saddens me because I look at children and I think, man, I was a child. And anybody that remembers Reds knows how powerful they were. Like, they had no legitimate reason to be taken, other than to just put you down, right? And I was taking like 2 to 4 of them and going to school. And that was my first overdose. And I remember taking 4 Reds and being in school And I was writing my school paper, and I was getting so loaded, and I kept dropping my pencil and not bending over to pick it up. And the other kids knew what was going on, so they tried to straighten me in my chair so that the nun wouldn't catch me. And I'd drop the paper again, and I'd try to write. And then eventually they saw what was going on, and the nun turned to me, and I just started projectile vomiting, and I was overdosing. And the nuns told me, they said, listen, we're not going to tell your mom. My mom was dying of cancer. And they said, if you tell the truth, we're not going to tell her. And I had been in a little street gang, and we knew you don't ever tell the truth. But that day I took a chance, and I took a flyer on the truth. And I said, yeah, that's I've been doing it. Well, when I got off the school bus, my mom pulled me in the laundry room, and she said, the nuns came by today. And she said, now my mom's dying of cancer, right? I'm a mama's boy. I was named after my dad's childhood hero. And they had all these hopes and dreams for this kid. And the world was totally unprepared for drug addiction in the mid-60s for young people. And you know what? Looking back, not a hell of a lot's changed. You know, we've come so far in so many ways, but we've gone such a short distance in how to address the needs of the young people, right? I was a kid in crisis. And my mom said to me, she said, you know, what you've done. And she just whacked me with the only tool she had, and it was shame. I'm so ashamed of you. Shame, shame, shame. And when it was all said and done, she said, carry it to your grave. I'm going to carry it to mine. Now get out of here. You make me sick. And I walked out of that laundry room that day, a 12-year-old boy, what I now know would be a child in crisis. And I walked out of there and I thought, man, I'm so wrong. And my whole life, people have been saying, man, what's wrong with you? You know, I could run, I could hurdle, I was a good basketball player. You know, I was smart, I could do whatever I wanted, but all I seemed to do was screw up. And so my mom, she used the only tool she had, and that was shame. And my dad, every time I screwed up, used the only tool he knew, and that was the strap. And man, he would give it to me, right, to try to straighten out this kid. And then, you know, later on, the police get involved, and out come the handcuffs, and that didn't change me. My mom's shame didn't change me. My dad's strap didn't change me. The handcuffs didn't change me. The judge's sentences didn't change me. The military's court-martials didn't change me. The love of my beautiful, smoking hot wife, Donna, didn't change me. When she gave me the gift of sons, and I held my boys up to the sky out in Arizona when my boys were born, like, it's like the Lion King, you know? It's like, man, I got boys, right? I'll kill for my sons. I'll die for my sons, but I couldn't get sober for my sons. And nothing in my life worked. And every time I tried and every time I failed, I hated myself that much more. And so by the time someone worked their 12-step on me, I had 1 foot in the grave. A grave I'd been digging since I was a child. And so my life, I'm filled with all this incredible shame. And you know, my mom, she dies. And when she dies, my dad bolts. He didn't, like, physically leave. He just disconnected from life. You know, I think my mom died because it was the only way she could get rest with having 10 kids, right? And so here I am, you know, like instantly my mom's dead, my dad's gone, sell the house, move away. My little brother, he ships to Arizona, and there I am. Me with no coping skills in this increasing love of narcotics. I mean, I love narcotics. I'm the guy that likes to take 4 hits of acid and then smoke some angel dust behind it. You know, I mean, I have always used to the extreme. I didn't know it was the extreme. That's just how the cat's eye rolled with went. I had no idea. I would have died if it wasn't for someone working their 12-step on me, because I didn't know there was a possible solution. You know, I'm so grateful for old groups like this that have been around a long, long time. And if you think over the 30 years of this log cabin group, how many lives have been changed as a result of you keeping those doors open? Because, see, I didn't know where to go. And I don't think I could have caught on anywhere else. By the time I got to Cocaine Anonymous, I was so fragile. I'd been praying for death. My marriage is on the rocks. My kids have no respect for me. My dogs growl at me. My parents are both dead. My brothers and sisters won't talk to me. The whole world turned its back on me. And Cocaine Anonymous opened its arms to me. And when I came in here, nobody told me. I made a lot of mistakes. And they just taught me about a power that creates change in a human heart. It's the power that is contained in the 12 steps. And it's called the power of love. It is said that if you have seen the face of love, you have seen the face of God. I found God through the loving faces of the members of Cocaine Anonymous. And as a result of my journeys through the steps, as a result of the things that have changed over the years, because, you know, cocaine, when it first came out, was absolutely considered a non-addictive drug. The reason we have Cocaine Anonymous is because the members, the cats that started our fellowship in Southern California, people were dying all over the country from this non-addictive drug. And what was happening is that when they would go to AA, they said, "We don't want it. Don't mention that drug shit here." And then when they would go to NA, everybody was like, "Oh, cocaine, oh, you two little line," or whatever it is. But anybody who's ever been addicted to cocaine, any cocaine addicts in this house with me? You know what it's like? There is no drug. You want to talk about unleashing the hounds of hell? That's what got turned loose on me. I had no idea. This non-addictive drug became more important than my children, more important than my wife, more important than anything else in the world to me. I sold my soul. And it was all non-addictive. And in the beginning, cocaine had a hook. Especially for you guys. Let me tell you the hook. These ladies. Man, I'm telling you what, when you would do that cocaine, it was ladies' night every night. Well, it's ladies' night. And we all family push it up. The dance floor was full, man. I'm telling you. And everybody doing them little bumps. And I remember me and my wife, man, we go get a little gram. And we snort a couple little lines with some other friends. And then save a half a gram for the next weekend. And you know, I know that may not be some of your experiences, but let me tell you what, cocaine and drugs could not have done so much to me if they hadn't done so much for me. You put that cocaine in me, and I'd stop being shy. I'm telling you what's up, ladies? I'll hook you up. Look at them dudes. Go, "What's your problem, man? You need ass whooping?" I'd whip Rocky Balboa's ass. Rocky? Shit. Rocky Balboa is a pussy. And that motherfucker Freddy Krueger, that's a real pussy. I'd whip Freddy Krueger's ass too. And the song was beautiful. Dance floors were full. And then something happened and the song changed. And oh man, no more partying with you. That dope said, "We ain't, you know, my story would still be, we're going to go get a little song, we're going to have some fun, hang out with the folks at the club." But then, man, what would happen to me is just always like this. I'm just going to go have me a couple drinks after work, just two, maybe one. I'd get me a rum or coke in me, and then right away my mind would say, "You know, Terry, you need to get some cocaine. You cannot afford another DUI. And you know, with that cocaine, you can, yeah, with cocaine, you can. You can drink more and you can drive better. So out comes the cocaine. And then they changed the cocaine. And all of a sudden you go to get that little powder and you go, I got none of that, but I got this rock. Well, what's that? You know, I never met a bad habit I didn't like. I swear to God, my whole life is like this, man. How many times did I forget important papers that I had worked on for school reports at home? Countless times. I've been on camping trips where I forgot the sleeping bag, the tent, or the pan to cook the bacon and eggs in. But not on any one of those trips did I ever forget my dope or my 100-proof schnapps. Bad habits in me. I think Elton John had a song, Bad Habits in Me, but pretty good company. I mean, it was like shit. It was perfect for me. I never met a drug I didn't like. When I started shooting heroin, I was in the military overseas, and there were junkies pouring out of Southeast Asia, and you could tell the junkie rooms because you look up at the barracks, and it was the ones with the puke stains out the windows. And there were a lot of windows like that. You know, drugs have created unbelievable suffering. Drugs and alcohol have created tremendous suffering in our world. And first time I shot heroin, hell, I never got sick. I never belched. I loved it. I just naturally took to this stuff. But along the way, you know, as I started hurting people, as I started breaking hearts, as I started hating myself, as I started withdrawing from the world and the parties and the nightlife, you know, I like the nightlife, I like the boogie, you know, not anymore. It's me alone with that pipe. And man, I hit that pipe, and then the minute I hit that pipe, it would be straight to the window or straight to the people or straight to the dealer, looking on the floor, seeing the police, seeing the lights flashing, hearing the police dog growling on the other side of the door. Ready to come and get me. And I paid money I didn't have to feel like that. In the end, I'm on methadone, even though I hadn't shot heroin for 14 years. But I went to the first place to try to get some help, and it was a place that really wasn't there to help. And they said, well, you know what, man, what we're going to do, you really want to get sober, so we're going to put you on this methadone and help you. I didn't know it was a number and a check. But I was glad to take methadone. That's why I'm so grateful for the message of Cocaine Anonymous. Cocaine and all other mind-altering substances. I'm grateful for the fact that I'm a member of the most open and loving fellowship in the world. In Cocaine Anonymous, we don't care anything about it. Where you've been or what you did, we're just glad you're here. I got a friend of mine, his name is Reggie L. And Reggie was best friends with a cat named Johnny S., who was instrumental in helping to grow the fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous. And Reggie's the man we owe our openness and our fellowship to. Because Reggie was a black man growing up in America and experiencing things that, unless you experienced it, you couldn't understand. And so when Reggie got sober, he had known all about not being wanted. Hell, who wants drug addicts? My family didn't. You know, nobody did. The only people that really wanted the addicts was the Department of Corrections. And so Reggie, when they got together, and he was one of the founders of our fellowship, he said, man, we got to make this thing so it's open to everybody. There can't be a rule. There can't be a way that you have to share this particular way. And that's how it all began, born on other people's experiences. And so when I came in here so broken and fragile and wounded, if someone would have told me to change what I had said, it could have fractured me. See, I don't ever want to forget how hard it is to be a newcomer. I don't ever want, and the reason that I don't forget it is because I stay in the trenches with sponsorship. I love working with guys. I remember one of my very first sponsees taught me a thing. So I'm a smoker now, right? So I'm smoking, I'm on methadone, I'm eating pain pills like crazy. My marriage is on the rocks. My children are hurting. My life is falling apart. I can't stop using. I've violated every sacred relationship in my life. And I'm talking about violated them in horrible ways. I give you a story of what addiction did to me. I'm a good guy with a bad disease. And my wife, Donna, and I, we had one boy, and he was 2.5. And she got pregnant again, and the miracle of life began. And we were so excited, right? We're not bad people, it's a bad disease. And when my wife, Donna, she's at a Kohanon family groups retreat in Arizona this weekend. And in the first Kohanon meeting she started in Arizona, she named Off the Roller Coaster. She said, because being married to you has been like being on a roller coaster. She goes, but there ain't no fun on this ride because I'm not sitting in a car. I'm tied to the back of the tracks. Up and down, things go good. The cars get repoed, the infidelities, the dishonesties. I'd pop the checks out of the middle. I got so sick in my addiction that I remember I popped the checks out of the middle of the checkbook. Write the check to get $80 worth of crack cocaine. And then my wife would come to me and she'd say, honey, did you take money out of the bank? You know, back then it wasn't ATM. It was a little different in those days. I don't know how the hell y'all do it now with the access to money right everywhere. And I said, no, I didn't. Why do you always accuse me of stuff? And then, well, you had to have. All right, well, I did. And then she said, well, how much did you take? $40. Even though I'm already busted, I'm going to have to take the ass whooping twice. But I couldn't spit out the truth, and my thinking was so delusional that I had convinced myself that I was doing that for her good. Because that way, because I'm protecting her feelings. I'm insane, right? I mean, I'm in so much trouble. You know, and so my wife gets pregnant, miracle life. We're really excited. I'm in the good phase, right? I'm a good dude with a good heart. And I'm working hard and take care of my family, and we're excited because I'm a binger, right? I'm a guy that I'll do good for a while, and then, man, one day you turn around and, oh, shit. I'm gone. All the money's gone. The jewelry's gone. The VCR's gone. It's gone. And I was in a good phase. And at the 7th month of pregnancy, my wife's out to here, and she said, honey, something's wrong, and the baby's not moving. So we were going through natural childbirth through counterculture old hippies, right? So we go down to this natural birthing center and they did an ultrasound and they came back and they said, Mr. and Mrs. Murphy, we're really sorry, but your son's dead. And then they turned to my wife and they said, ma'am, in keeping with the natural order of things, you need to carry this dead child to terms. So think about this. I'm a drug addict. I don't know I am. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know I am. I have no idea how to deal with fear. I have no idea how to deal with feelings. We walked out of that hospital, no clergy and no counsel. Her out to here. And everywhere we went, the story was the same. Is it a boy or a girl? You go teach him to play ball? Have you decorated the room yet? And after a month, maybe a month and a half of that, we couldn't take it anymore. She goes, they got to take this baby or I'm going to kill myself. I just learned those were her thoughts this year. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. She has never felt the need to share that with me. We called them out, they induced labor. You know, we're not always the ones that are wrong. The room they put us in was right across from the nursery. And all day long, people are going to the window to tap on it to see their little babies. While my wife went through 8 hours of labor and I held her hand, push, Lamaze childbirth to give birth to our dead son. They wrapped Brandon in a blanket and they tried to hand me my boy and I stepped back and I wouldn't take him and I left my son's body at the hospital. I didn't know what to do. Except from the day that they told us he was dead, I did the only thing I knew. First thing I found to drink was like Tia Maria or some shit. But it was just get something in me to help me to deal with what I'm feeling. At home, we got this little boy who's wondering what the hell happened to his life. Mom and Dad used to be laughing and talking about his brother, and nobody's talking about that, and all we do is cry now. We get home from the hospital. 1 to 2 weeks max had passed, and I fled the state with one of my wife's girlfriends. Now, let me ask you a question. How do you work your step 9 on that one? How do you ever make amends to your son or to my boys for robbing them of their childhood? I had guilt and pain and shame up to here before I came into these rooms. I didn't know what to do with it other than to keep drinking and drugging. None of those things made me an addict. I understand looking back, the evidence was there long before that. But so what happened is that my life is falling apart. I can't stop using. My wife and I get back together. We got this strong attraction. We have another boy, and I still can't, you know, it's like I can't stop. And then somebody worked their 12 step on me. And here's how it went down. I'd been praying for death. I'd been sleeping like this, and my arm would go up involuntarily at night. And my wife, Donna, would push that hand down. She was planning her escape. She had it all figured out. As soon as the school year was over, she was taking the kids and going somewhere. Because she had to go somewhere because she said she knew I would die on her doorstep. I was 140 pounds, sucked up, strung out. And I'd be laying in that bed and my hand would go up like this and she'd push it down. And I never gave that much thought. Why did that happen to me night after night? You know, the sleep of the damned. The crack coming out of your pores. The no real sleep. That twilight. That no midnight suffering. That's what my life was like. First thing in the morning, a handful of pills. You know, hit some booze. Get down for my methadone. At 5:30, that was my life. But yet I'm surrounded by a woman that I love, a family that still loves me. But I know I got this God who doesn't give a shit about me because of all the things I've done, so I think. And man, she pushed that hand out. I've thought about that since. Because a couple of days later, I walk into a pawn shop. And I'm in this pawn shop, and the dude in the pawn shop looks at me and he says, "Dude, I don't know if you're in trouble or not." And the minute he started going, I thought, oh shit, here we go. One more person going to tell me what's wrong with me. One more lecture. One more bit of shame. Pile it on. There's nothing anybody could say to a newcomer that the newcomer hasn't already said to themselves. That's why I love CA. Because what I got when I came here was I got hugs. I remember walking to one of my very first CA meetings and this girl, Denise, came up to me. She was a detox nurse. And she walked up to me and she said, "Hi, can I have a hug?" I said, "Sure thing, baby." I still got it. You know. So, you know, it's like, I'm in this terrible place. And this man, know what was different is that he knew the big book and he knew recovery. And he turned and he said, "I don't know if you're in trouble or not, but if you are, I used to be in trouble." And it was the first time anybody ever done that. See, in Cocaine Anonymous, we don't tell you what's wrong with you. I'm not telling you what's wrong with you tonight. I'm telling you what's been wrong with me. And he started doing that. And in the middle of this miracle, right? I mean, I'm in the middle of a miracle. I've been praying, "God, take me, save me, something." I'm in the middle of a miracle. And what I was doing was judging that man. I'm thinking, this poor bastard, I'll let him preach a while longer, get some extra money for my Bose speakers. I got that money that day, and I went and I copped, right? And I went and I was driving a stolen van, and I went and I smoked. And I smoked till there was nothing left to smoke, and I threw that pipe out. I walked through the doors of that detox, and I said, Called my wife. I said, I've turned myself in for treatment. She said, thank God. You know, I stayed in there. I was in there for 4 days. I had my first clear thought after 4 days. And you know what that thought was? I bet you there's another hit in that pipe. Just then they announced AA meeting next door. So I followed them all out. They all went right to go to Bill Wilson Hall. I went left to go to the field. I crawled around like a dog on my hands and knees. And I found that pipe. And I stuck it in the waistband. I pulled the stickers out of my hair. I went in that bathroom and I put the fire to it. I'm seeing them oils. I go, whoa. I'll take this. I took the biggest hit I ever took. I blew out the biggest cloud of smoke I ever blew out. And I felt nothing. And then I saw my reflection in the steel mirror of this county facility. And there was something on my lip. And I went like that. And then it crawled down my hand. It was a bug. And I looked in that bowl, and it was filled with the burnt remnants of bugs. I had just smoked bugs. Them bugs had found that crack pipe, and they were all in there. You know, I fucked up their party. So I took that pipe and I threw it in the trash can. That's my sobriety date, May 23rd, 91. Even though I went into detox on the 19th, my intent to get high was on that day. I threw the pipe in the trash can. I climbed on top of a plastic-covered mattress and I said, God, help me. I had no belief. But, oh, man, when there's no one else to turn to. I get transferred to another detox. They tell me you have to go to a meeting across the hall. And it was a meeting of Cocaine Anonymous. And I walked in and I heard laughter. And I heard people talking about smoking and drinking and drugging and crazy shit. Peeking out the windows and bent people. And I'm hearing about all this stuff. And they're talking about this insanity. And I'm thinking, shit, man, that's how I use. And so with that first bit, I started to feel maybe a little bit of hope. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to go into treatment. A lot of people die before they get there. And as my wife and I are driving, she's driving me to treatment. And as I'm driving to treatment, I was struck with a terror that I had never known before. Now, I've been in some tough spots, and I'm just not that scared. You know, when they asked me in treatment, they said, what do you fear more, dying or losing your family? I said, losing my family. And then people go, that's bullshit. Death is final and all that. I go, you don't get it. I'm already dead. I am the walking dead. And as my wife is driving me to this treatment center, I had this picture of what sobriety was. And I thought, no more laughter, no more fun. How am I going to watch a Super Bowl without a couple of brews or go shoot some hoops or play some pool or do something? How am I going to get through this thing? My only coping skill from the time I was 12 years old had been drugs and alcohol. And now that's all going away. And I've never seen the book. I've never seen the line, have you a sufficient substitute? All I know is I'm dying on the inside. And this picture of what sobriety looked like was horrifying to me. I had sober and somber confused in my mind. I thought this is what somebody who was sober looked like. Greetings. I'm sober. This sucks. Now, you got to follow me on this. My wife drove me 7 miles from the detox to the treatment center. Her jewelry's all in the pawn shop. I had traded my wedding ring for a $20 rock. I got a baby in the grave. My parents are both dead. My family won't talk to me. I'm sick. I'm dying. I'm hopeless. And in that 7 mile drive, my mind convinced me that this was going to suck. There is a line in the literature that said there is no evidence anywhere that anyone has ever won in single-handed combat against this disease. I have been fighting the beast. I've been getting in that cage with that beast. I've been getting my ass kicked my whole life. So what ends up happening is as the tears start pouring out of my face, and as my wife pulled into treatment, I turned to her. I said, you know, Donna, you may not like what comes out of here. And she looked at me and she said, you know, I'm not that crazy about the son of a bitch going in. So I go to this Right, so I get in this treatment center called Valley Hope. Now I get in there, man, I'm jacked, right? I mean, I am detoxing, I am sick, I am insane. And I'm in there and I'm waiting for this thing called recovery. Some dude walks up to me and goes, "Can I have a hug?" Oh man, what are you, man, no, ain't nobody hugging me. What is going on? And at this treatment center, some people wore crowns and stuff down, thinking, "Where am I?" And so finally I'm in there and they're like, "It's finally time to get around to the business of recovery after a long weekend of detox and walking around locked up inside and crazy." And the back door opens up and the room's divided just like this. So the patients all stood up. Well, I'm a chameleon. I stood up. And the patients started to sing. So help me God, they sang. They used, because they understood that cocaine was isolating everybody, right? In the beginning, it's an outward movement. What's happening? And in the end, it's like, right, locked up. So what they did is they used a model of therapy to force you out of yourself, and they would make the patient sing. Now, I don't know this, but the patients start to sing, and here's the song. I'm standing with them. I'm a couple of days out of it. I'm not well. And the song starts. Here's our assignments coming down. There's hope for you and me. V-A-L-L-E-Y, there's hope for you and me. And this half of the room goes, V-A-L. And then over here they went, L-E-Y. And then they all went like, just like this. They went, Y, and they hugged themselves. Why? Because we love you. There's hope for you and me. And I went, oh! Oh my God. I am in a Mickey Mouse club from hell. My mind is going, run. And then my other mind is going, where? One of the counselors heard me scream, and he came over to me, goes, "Whoa, hold on a minute, man. I mean, I'm just like a couple of days off of smoking bugs. I am. There's only two side effects. One is that I don't have to have a pest control company because I'll piss outside my house. Bugs all stay away. And the other nuisance is whenever I hear crickets chirp, I get a heart. But I know someday that'll probably go away. So here I am, and here's what the counselor said to me. He said, "Dude, I know you want to run. Everybody wants to run. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do?" I had nobody go. Cocaine Anonymous was the last block on the house from last house on the block, so I settled in, and I started doing the work. And I surrendered. I didn't know I'd surrendered. And they'd give me an assignment. They'd go, "Read this." And I'd read it. And they'd say, "Write this." And I'd write it. See, I knew that was surrender. See, there's a thing called compliance. I see it all the time with men that I work with. "Hey, man, why don't you do this? I'll give them some step work." Now, let me tell you what. If they smoke crack like they did step work, they never would end up in the rooms. Because you give it to them, and it's like, "Here's step work. Oh, I get to that in the next couple of weeks." I've chased this work like I chased the hit. Dr. Bob says in his story that if you do that, if you put half the effort into your recovery that you put into your destruction, program never fails. So I started doing the work, and I've been doing the work. And then I started watching the people who were happy, joyous, and free. Started meeting people like those folks who greeted me and worked that service line today. People that kept coming up and welcomed me here. And I started doing all their stuff. I started doing that stuff. And I just followed the leader. Literally, that's all it is, following the leader, right? But the cool thing is that Cocaine Anonymous, the God of your own understanding, is the leader. And so I started doing the work, right? But they started talking about stuff like H&I, so I started doing H&I. I said to this dude who was cool, right? He drove a vet and he had this hot girlfriend. I said, "Man, you keep talking about this H&I. How do I get involved in that?" He goes, "You got to have 6 months." I said, "Well, cool. But I got 30 days. He goes, "Well, 6 months, I'll take you." And then when I got a 90-day chip, he said, "You're getting closer." He was the first one to hug me when I got my 6-month chip. He said, "I will see you Wednesday morning." We had breakfast that Wednesday morning. and we went and did a meeting in the county jail. I met that man this Wednesday for breakfast, and we went and did a meeting in the county jail, and we met every Wednesday between there for the last 26 and a half years. Now that's an amazing thing for a man who leaves his wife. That's an amazing thing for a man who smokes his wedding ring. That's an amazing thing for a kid who robs his own children, for a man who robs his own children. And so what happened is that I started to regain my dignity and my self-worth by doing things that are, you know, you want better self-esteem, do esteemable things. Yeah. And so one of those things, by being involved in that, has kept me connected to the newcomers. And so that's where my heart is. And so things started changing, and my boys started respecting me, and my wife started loving on me again. And you know, slowly, I earned her respect and trust over time. Because all I did was one thing. I did one thing, man. I got this message from my higher power. My life was a mess. I thought, how am I ever going to make it right? And I heard my higher power. See, I think God's still talking. He talks through you to me all the time. And sometimes in silence, I hear His whisper. And what I heard Him say was, Terry, your life's a mess. Don't worry about that. All you got to do is one thing. You put your relationship with God and crooked and honest at the center of your life, I'll take care of the rest. So I started doing the work. And next thing you know, man, my wife's loving me. She gave me a card not long ago that said her favorite place is as close as she could get to me. Wow. My sons, they started respecting me. My brothers and sisters started coming to me for advice. But I still had these wounds that were in the grave, right? This child, this mother, this father. And as a result of prayer and meditation, I've had vital spiritual experiences where I have been in my Father's presence in meditation. And I knew we were cool. I had an experience with my son that I left in that hospital. In Notre Dame Cathedral. And I knew it was him on my heart. I knew it was him. I felt it. Tears started flowing down my face. I knew it was my son. It was me and my wife on Father's Day in Notre Dame Cathedral, and I had 20-some years of sobriety. The healing is God's business. My business is the work that leads to the healing. And so as I'm there, I'm sitting there, and I'm feeling this, and the tears started, and I got the gift of tears, right? They just kept coming, and they wouldn't stop. And I knew they were for my boy. His name was Brandon. And at one point, I took these tears streaming down my face and I made the sign of the cross over my wife's heart. And I said words that went something like this: from a broken father's heart to heal a wounded mother, or something like that. And the mass was all in French. I don't speak French. But I knew every word they were saying that day in Notre Dame Cathedral. And so I go walking up and everybody says, "See, I didn't," and they're saying these words and they're hanging up the post. And I go walking up. And this old priest man had been 90 years old. And he's speaking French. And I'm trying to like hear what they're saying so I can see the right thing. And I go up there like that to get the host. And this old man looks me in the eyes. And he put the host in my hand. And he closed my hand and put his hands over it. And in perfect English, he looked in my eyes. And he said, "God heals." That takes my breath away today. The only thing that limits the power of God is my lack of willingness to stay in the trenches. And so that mother who I disappointed so much, I'm meditating one day, and in meditation, my mom, when she got towards the end, her cancer had broken off and she couldn't speak. She had what was called, I think it's called an embolism or something. And so it blocked her brain patterns. She couldn't speak. And my job, when I come home from school now I'm a 15-year-old boy filled with shame, and I'm feeding my mom with an eyedropper with vitamins and like gruel, oatmeal, or cream of wheat or something. And I got the eyedropper, and I'm putting it in my mom's mouth like I do every day after school to feed her, and she won't take it. She's going, And I start to lose it because I know if she doesn't take nourishment, she's going to die. And if she dies, I got this wound. I don't even know I have this wound. Because by now, I've got years of drinking and drugging poured on top of that. I have no idea what the hell I feel. I just know nothing's working. And as I'm trying to feed my mom with this eyedropper, she's going, And I said to her, "Now listen to me on this. My mom died when I was 15 in 1971. I was 50 years old when this happened. That means I had been sober a long time. A lot of years had passed. And I'm trying to see God works slow on His time. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. It will always materialize if we work for it. And my part of working for it is to avail myself to a process called meditation. And so I'm trying to give her that eyedropper. She's going, and I look at her, I go, "What, Mom?" And she said, "I love you, baby." Those were her last words. My whole life, from the time I was that kid in the seventh grade, when she said, "Get out of here, you make me sick," I thought those were my mother's last words to me my whole life. How freeing was that? How do I ever pay Cocaine Anonymous and prayer and meditation and others back for that gift of healing? So I've healed, and I'm healing, and more is being revealed, and I'm in the mix, and I'm having a love affair with my wife, because I decided if I'm going to do this thing called recovery, I'm going to learn about recovery. And if I'm going to do this thing called marriage, I'm going to learn how to love my wife. And if I'm going to be a grandpa and a father, I'm going to learn how to love my children and my granddaughters. And so as a result of all of that stuff, we went through hell and back, right? My wife was with me through years of unbelievable, horrific addiction. Shooting up without needles, overdoses, arrests, bankruptcies, repos, infidelities, you name it. I dragged that poor, beautiful woman by her hair through hell. But in recovery, she's healed. Not by me, but through the God of her own understanding. Because I know my part is to do my work, and it's Donna's part to do Donna's work. And as a result, we've been doing this stuff together and healing over time. So, August 5th, right, that's just a few days away, will be our 40th wedding anniversary. Woo! Let me tell you something. We are people that deserve to celebrate life. Because we all experienced death. We all know what it's like to be dead inside, and we know what it's like to be alive now, so we get to experience life. So here's what we're doing for our 40th. My wife always wanted to go to Machu Picchu. I said, "Okay, you pick the place, that's where we're going." So we're going to Machu Picchu. What my wife Donna doesn't know is the rest of the story. I said, "Is it okay if I plan the rest of the trip?" And she said, "Yeah, go for it." So what she doesn't know is that we're going to fly into Lima and then out into the jungle. And we're going to get on a boat and go down the Amazon River. Cool. And we're going to spend nights up in a tree. We're staying in a treehouse. This treehouse is big too, right? Bathroom, giant king-size bed. It's going to get work too, I promise. It ain't need no Viagra either because trust is the new Viagra. And we're going to be up there. Let me tell you. I said, "Which is the most romantic?" He said, "Well, it's at the top of the trees. It's 60 meters off the ground." That's the one for me. They go, "Well, you're 60 feet. You want to climb the stairs?" You bet. I'm going to climb them stairs. And I promise you, them trees don't be rock. I'm already working on my car plan, right? So I'm going to tell her, "You came. Meet Tarzan. Let's roll." So we're going to have this time there, right? And then we're going to fly back and we're going to end up in Machu Picchu. But what my wife Donna doesn't know is the rest of the story. I'm flying her sons and her granddaughters and daughter-in-laws and sneaking them into Peru. I picked out a wedding dress for my wife. I hire a shaman in Peru to renew our wedding vows in Machu Picchu. She doesn't know any of this. And when she walks up wearing that dress that I selected, the flower girls that are going to come out are her grandbabies. That's called healing. Because what the deal is every one of us have paid a tremendous price for our seats in Cocaine Anonymous. Every one of us have paid a hell of a price in our own ways, in our own time. You know, broken relationships with loved ones and families. So my message to you tonight is that God heals. Not only can He heal your relationships here in the living years, that's what the amends process is about, but the power of this program, the power of God is great enough to reach even into the grave. Can heal the wounds that you don't even know you have. Because we have this program that is so incredibly powerful. So I am incredibly grateful to all of you to let me share my love and my heart with you here tonight. So thank you and peace. Love you.